Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. 50 years ago today, music history was made. It was made by four young men, and they didn't even have to sing a note or pick up an instrument, write down a lyric, or play a melody. All they had to do to ensure their place in music history was to step off the plane.
3,000 screaming teenagers are at New York's Kennedy Airport to greet, you guessed it, the Beatles. This rock and roll group has taken over as the kingpins of musical appreciation among the younger element. Some music critics call their harmony unmistakably diatonic. Others say it's pandiatonic.
Yeah, I don't think that guy knows what the word diatonic means. And I sure don't know what that last word means, but I do know this. When the Beatles landed at JFK here in New York on this date in 1964, everything changed, including apparently our language. Today on Soundcheck, Beatles biographer and New York Times culture reporter Alan Kozin joins us to look back at the time when we first got to meet the Beatles. Also, singer-songwriter, guitarist, political activist, and actor Steve Earle joins us to play live. But first...
From Russia with love.
All week on Soundcheck, we've been looking at Russian pop culture and music in a series called From Russia with Soundcheck. And even now, at the end of the series, we're all still looking at each other and going, who came up with that title again? But as our gaze turns east... finally, to the Olympic Games in Sochi, let's not forget that there's a little bit of Russia right here in New York. The Brooklyn neighborhood of Brighton Beach has long been known for its Russian-speaking population, and today we'll get a guided tour of Russian culture, Brooklyn style. Alexander Rudoy is owner of Aria Entertainment and the co-choreographer of the big music and dance spectacles that take place at Tatiana's, a central gathering place for the Russian immigrant community. Alexander, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you.
So tell us a little bit about Tatiana's. Is it like a supper club, dinner theater kind of thing?
Tatiana is a big place. It's a bit of a nightclub and a restaurant altogether. They have shows on the weekends, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. If you want to come and see, it's at Saturdays and Fridays at 10 o'clock, and then on Sundays at 8:30.
So it's kind of a late show.
It's kind of
Fridays
a late show,
and
yes.
Saturdays.
Yes. They also have live music, live musicians,
right.
Singers. They have a dance floor. It's a thrilling experience if you've never been to one.
So the point is that for the Russian community and for the Russian-speaking community, they're not all Russians, lots of people from the nearby republics as well.
Yes.
Is this a chance to kind of hear music from back home? Is that the kind of thing that you hear?
Well, yes, they do sing a lot of Russian music, not necessarily folk music, but popular music. They also sing songs from Europe, from different countries, as well as American songs. So Russians are very curious when it comes to other cultures. They like to expand, they like to experience. And, for example, all of the sushi places we have in Brooklyn are filled with Russians because they enjoy different cultures. They enjoy experiencing different things. So that's why Tatiana will be a mixed experience. You will hear songs in Russian. You will hear songs in English, in French, in other languages.
And where do the performers come from?
Most of the performers come from a former Soviet Union. From different republics that used to be. Now it's different countries, Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, and other places.
All right. So if I were to spend a late Friday night or Saturday night at this restaurant at Tatiana's, would this Valenke song, would this be the kind of thing I would hear?
You would hear that in the show. I use that music when I choreographed the show. It's a traditional Russian folk song remixed into a more modern beat.
And what's happening on stage while we're hearing this?
What's happening on stage, you will see Russian dancers dressed in, some of them are dressed in traditional Russian costumes. The others are dressed in more Vegas-y style, good-looking girls. with huge headpieces. So it's kind of an interesting experience, especially for Americans that have never seen that before.
All right. So Valenke, a remix of this old Russian folk song. One of the things you might run into during an evening in Brighton Beach. The song, there's a folk song in there somewhere.
Yes,
Valenke
is
the name of it. Alexander Rudoy is owner of Aria Entertainment, a choreography and entertainment company based in Brooklyn. And so while this is playing in the restaurant at Tatiana's, you've got the dancers going
Absolutely.
Up on stage. How big a place is Tatiana's, and are there other places like it in Brighton Beach?
Tatiana is pretty big, actually. They have just acquired the place next door also, so it's pretty big. I think it fits around 400 people, I think, maybe more. There used to be many places like Tatiana in Brooklyn, but I guess the economy had a big effect on a lot of them disappearing.
Right.
At this point, the only two places that have the shows are Romanov, which is former Rasputin, that's in Coney Island Avenue, which is close to Brighton Beach, and Tatiana, which is located right on Boardwalk.
Mm-hmm. So your last name is Rudoy. That's not a Russian name. Where are you from?
Well, I was born in Lvov, which is Western Ukraine. I'm actually Jewish by descent, which a lot of people living in Brighton Beach are Jewish by descent.
Right.
Some of them are not, but a lot of them are. I grew up in Western Ukraine until I was 13 years old, and then I came here to the United States and live in New York ever since.
Yeah. When you were growing up, was it Ukraine or was it still Soviet Union?
It was still Soviet Union. I still left the Soviet Union.
Yeah. So did you grow up speaking Russian or Ukrainian or both?
Both, actually. At home, we spoke Russian. My grandparents spoke Yiddish. In school, we had to learn Ukrainian, so it was all three languages mixed in together.
Oh, okay. Now, they used to call Brighton Beach, and some of us still do, Little Odessa. And, of course, Odessa is a Ukrainian city that famously had a large Jewish population.
Yes.
Were the Russians there all along, or did they come, sort of in a later wave after the Jewish and Ukrainian immigrants?
Well, honestly, it all comes in waves. It depends. The first generation of immigrants, I think they were mostly Jewish, and then the next one was mostly Russian. And now there's a lot of people coming from Uzbekistan and from other countries of former Soviet Union. It all depends on, the political situation mostly.
Right.
So whoever's getting having problems in a country is trying to go to America. America, the country of opportunity and equality.
We're talking about Little Odessa, the neighborhood known as Brighton Beach in Brooklyn, which for many years has been kind of a haven of Russian culture here in the middle of New York. It's part of our week-long series called From Russia with Soundcheck in the run-up to the Sochi Olympics. So what else is happening? Where would people go for music in Brighton Beach? Is there a concert hall, a concert theater?
Absolutely. We have a very large, modernized theater. It's called Master Theater now. It used to be called Millennium Theater. I think it has 2,000 seats. Beautiful.
Wow, that's a big theater.
Yeah. It has a beautiful stage with dressing rooms and a lot of stars that come from former Soviet Union, from Russia, from Ukraine. They do perform in the space, and as well as a lot of local dance companies and local performers use the theater for the performances.
So next Friday and Saturday, this Russian pop star named Alexei Chumakov is performing. Is he the kind of person that will get out the older people, the kids? I mean, you know, who would he attract?
Probably middle age. People who remember him. Most of the people who've been living here, like me, for more than 20 years, you know, we are more following the American culture right. with the singers and the performers. But a lot of people still like, you know, there's a lot of rising stars right now. They all come here. They all are interested in the Brighton Beach population because, you know, they want to spread their art out. And they do come here a lot and perform for us. And actually, some performers are so popular that they have to rent bigger theaters, like the one at Taj Mahal in Atlantic City.
Wow. So there's a big enough Russian population or Russian-speaking population here that if you're a rising star in Russia, it behooves you to come here.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay.
And a lot of they also bring a lot of children's theater down here. They also bring ballets. They also bring the comedy shows. Hmm. So the market is pretty big, and we have a lot of things going on.
Yeah. Well, next Friday and Saturday, you can hear Alexei Chumakov, the Russian pop star, performing at the Master Theater in Brooklyn. Songs called Tutti Tam, Alexei Chumakov, Russian pop star, performing for the Russian community in Brighton Beach next Friday and Saturday at the Master Theater, which, as Alexander Rudoy was telling us, is the big 2,000-seater. But you're also saying, Alexander, that if it's like a huge star, everybody goes to Atlantic City.
Yeah, sometimes there's too many people who want to see to the performance, so they have to move to the bigger venue.
Yeah. What about homegrown talent in the Brighton Beach community in Brooklyn?
Oh, actually, that is a very interesting question because, to my opinion, a lot of the stars we have here are even better than the ones that are famous in Russia and Ukraine and the former Soviet Union. For example, some of the singers that we work with here, they always sing live. They don't have to do the recorded thing that a lot of Russian stars do.
So when this Chumakov fellow comes, he's likely to come with backing tracks and just play to tapes?
Sometimes they do that. But the performers that we have here, like Ella Zaslavsky is a singer who I work with all the time. She has been living here also for about 20 years. And she's absolutely astonishing and amazing singer, always sings live. I think Channel 13 did a special on her a couple of years ago.
And what kind of singer is she?
She can sing anything. That's the best part of the local singers that we have, is that they are trained to sing anything from folk songs to Russian songs to American songs to French songs to Spanish songs. They have a huge variety. And they are trained to perform live and perform beautifully.
Yeah. So her name is Ella?
Ella Zaslavsky.
Ella Zaslavsky. Mm-hmm. Let's hear a little bit from her. That's a little bit of music from Ella Zaslavsky, who is one of the, Well, not quite homegrown talents, but home-based here in Brooklyn. Alexander Rudoy with me on Soundcheck, and we're talking about the Russian community in Brighton Beach. She's been living here, you said, for about 20 years.
For about 20 years, yes. Also, Julia Mirishnichenko, also an amazing, amazing singer who I am very happy to be working with.
Sounds like a Ukrainian name.
She is from Ukraine, actually, yes. Yeah, she is from Ukraine, but once again, former Soviet Union. Brilliant singer. If she was staying in Russia, she would become a big star, but she chose to be living with us here in the United States.
Do any of these singers get to be big enough here that their reputations spread back home and that maybe
Absolutely, sure. The art of singing and the art of performing and the art of their presence on stage is so huge and amazing that I think a lot of our stars from back home should be learning from them.
Mm. Speaking of learning, Alexander, if you moved to Brighton Beach as a small kid, or if you were born there, because now, of course, there are several generations of Russian-speaking inhabitants in Brighton Beach, is there a place where you learn this stuff, where you learn, first of all, the Russian language, and then the Russian folk songs and the Russian music and all that kind of stuff?
Absolutely. For example, we have a children's theater. I actually run the theater. I am the director and the choreographer. It's called the Little Theater. We are specializing on working with kids that were born in the United States, but from Russian-speaking families. And we make musicals that we have wrote ourselves based on Russian fairy tales.
Yeah. So the kids grow up with some knowledge of their parents' culture.
Exactly. You know. And the best part is that the parents are, especially the grandparents, they thank us a lot because the kids that refused to speak Russian before, they start doing it because they are so involved with the theater that they are drawn into learning and not only learning how to act and sing and dance, but also how to speak the language, how to read, and how to write also.
Because we are, of course, talking about a different alphabet with
yes.
the Russian language. So we're talking about the community there in Brighton Beach, Little Odessa, as it has been known. So there's the Little Theater, there's the Master Theater, we mentioned Tatiana's, there's what is Rasputin called now?
Romanov.
If I go to Tatiana's, what's the best thing on the menu?
Well, the food is amazing. They have so many selections. I enjoy the filet mignon.
I want something Russian. I don't want to go to a Russian restaurant and have filet mignon.
I forgot. That's right. That's right. Well, the best dish you can try is blintzes with caviar. Black caviar is a very Russian thing. They are pretty expensive, but... But it's an interesting dish. If you want to try a simple dish that is very cheap, try Russian ravioli. It's called pelmeni. Pelmeni, it's a very easy dish to cook and very.
Is it like pierogi?
No, it's more like ravioli, like Italian raviolis, but they taste different. So you should try that.
All right.
There's a lot of Russian food that's there's borscht is considered Ukrainian food, but Russians, they also adopt it as their own as well. But if you want to try the more simple, less expensive food, there's a lot of small places you can visit. But if you want the lavish experience, most of my American friends, when I bring them there, they are in awe because they don't understand how you can have all these things in one place. How can they say we go to Broadway to see a Broadway show? We go to dinner, we go to a nice restaurant to eat some food, and we go to a lounge to listen to the music, and we go to a club to dance and. Here it's all in one. You come and you experience everything. It's pretty crazy.
It's a little bit of Russia right here in New York, the Brighton Beach neighborhood, Little Odessa, as it's known. And we've been speaking with Alexander Rudoy, owner of Aria Entertainment, a choreography and entertainment company based in the area. Alexander, thanks for talking us through your neighborhood.
Thank you so much.
Серым стал мой миг в день, когда уйдя, разрушил ты его. В чьи смотришь ты сейчас глаза? что мне не досказал. Скажешь в одночасье, с кем ты делишь смех и боль, и под чьей рукою замираешь, не дыша.
That's a little bit from the Brighton Beach singer Julia Mirushnichenko, whom my guest Alex Rudoy mentioned earlier in our discussion. Valentine's Day is next Friday, not that you need reminding. Soundcheck wants you to make your case for the most romantic song ever. We'll be airing some of your responses all next week on the show. Tell us what you think was the most romantic song of all at soundcheck.org or leave us a message at 866-939-1612. That's 866-939-1612. The Beatles probably have some songs that would qualify. Up next, we look back at their arrival at JFK Airport 50 years ago today. This is Soundcheck.
On the way to paperback was on my knee. Man, I had a dreadful flight. I'm back in the USSR. You don't know how lucky you are, boy. Back in the USSR.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. So all week we've been doing our series From Russia with Soundcheck. Now we're back in the USSR with the Beatles. Actually, the Beatles do have a tangential relationship to Russia, which we can talk about in a bit. But today is the 50th anniversary of the day when the Beatles first landed at JFK Airport. And joining me in the studio to talk about the Beatles' American invasion is New York Times culture reporter and author of a biography about the Beatles, Alan Kozin. Alan, welcome back.
Thank you, John. Great to be here.
So paint a picture for us of the scene, New York, February 1964. What was it like?
You know, at Kennedy Airport, there were probably a couple of thousand fans. I'm not sure there's an actual count, but we see film footage, and they're all over the airport. Not all of them were fans. Some people were there to protest.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. There were particularly among young men. I think people didn't like the fact that their girlfriends were so stuck on, you know, this mop top group. And, you know, when you see interviews with them, I can refer people to there's a video called The Beatles' First U.S. Visit that was done by the Maisels brothers, mm-hmm. Who were sort of great cinema verite artists. And this was sort of at the beginning of their career. They got access to the Beatles pretty much full time. They got to hang out with them in their hotel rooms. And they filmed everything on the trip. And in that footage and in TV station footage, which, you know, gets brought out on occasions like this, you see some of these interviews with, you know, sort of crew cut guys saying, you know, I don't like this Beatles stuff, you know. But most of the people were there to sort of, you know, scream and carry on and hold up signs saying, welcome, Beatles. And
had there ever been anything like this? I mean, did presidents get this kind of attention when they landed at airports?
Probably not. But, you know, Sinatra and Elvis Presley might have.
It's just phenomenal that people would come to see this, and yet they wouldn't come to see the president. I mean, President Johnson came a few days ago, and there's practically nobody here except reporters and photographers.
I'd rather listen to a good jazz show any day, like Mingus or Mulligan, but not the Beatles.
We don't like rock and roll.
Yeah.
But we think they're just great.
What's your music?
I go to Juilliard. Yeah. That's classical. It's all classical.
Yeah, what is it?
This is Italian arias and things. I just think they're the greatest.
I remember a time when there was a young man by the name of Frank Sinatra who generated this kind of excitement and this kind of a spark. And I don't think it's bad.
So now we're talking February 64. Things have built up pretty fast.
Things really have, because, you know, the record came out at the end of December, and Meet the Beatles, the first American album, came out in January. Radio stations were all over it. You know, disc jockeys, I think disc jockeys, especially in those days, who knows, maybe still it's a different kind of world of disc jockeys now, but had, you know, an innate sense of what was going to be big. And so you got people like Murray the K and Cousin Brucey on ABC and others who saw immediately that this was the thing to glom onto. So you had
and glom they did.
Yeah, they sure did.
So the Beatles, I mean, they came here, of course, to perform on the Ed Sullivan Show,
right,
which they did 2 days after landing. So Sunday is the 50th anniversary of that. The first song on the first Sullivan appearance is All My Loving. What do you make of that, that they chose that song and not I Want to Hold Your Hand, for example?
All My Lovin' is a song that parents like. I mean, it's a song kids now, like, too.
Yeah.
Well, now, but I mean, actually, pretty quickly, parents began to see that as a great melody. And, I mean, I know mine did. Mine were pretty dismissive of the Beatles at first, but All My Lovin' was the first thing they focused on is, you know, this is actually not bad.
Right, well, maybe they recognize the cross-generational nature of Ed Sullivan's audience.
And
we're playing to the kids in the cheap seats, but the adults down in front as well. All My Loving from the Beatles.
And then while I'm away, I'll ride home every day, and I'll send all my loving to you. I'll pretend that I'm kissing the lips I am missing, and hope that my dreams will come true. And then while I'm away, I'll ride home every day, and I'll send all my loving to you. All my loving I will send to you. All my loving, darling, I'll be true.
Today is the 50th anniversary of the Beatles landing in New York at JFK Airport. Two evenings later, the first of three shows, Alan,
right,
at the Ed Sullivan Show. And they were paid the grand sum of
$10,000,
which, I mean, in those days was not chump change, but still.
It wasn't chump change, but it was actually less than Sullivan paid for certain other, you know, top name acts. I mean, Sullivan got a deal from his point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Brian Epstein got a deal from his point of view because he got three shows for the Beatles. And, you know, and Ed Sullivan didn't totally know who the Beatles were. I mean, there's this story of him arriving at London Airport and seeing the Beatles come back from Sweden and all the ruckus going on there and saying, you know, who is this? And he claimed he signed them right away. But it's not really what happened. There is actually some question whether he was even at London Airport, but I've never got totally to the bottom of that. But when he came back, Brian Epstein arranged a meeting with him in November 63 when he was here on a, you know, trying to stir some stuff up for the Beatles. And Sullivan, you know, asked his assistant, who are the Beatles? You know, and somehow or other, Brian persuaded him. And he took a chance, signed them on for three shows. And by the time the shows came around in February, it was really clear that, you know, this is the main event of these shows.
And who else? What were the other acts that were on those Ed Sullivan shows?
Well, Wells and the Four Fays. Do you remember them?
No. were,
I don't really either, and I've watched that show many times. I think they were sort of like an acrobatic kind of act. And, but there was a scene in the first show, there was a scene from Oliver, which starred Georgia Brown, but also the Artful Dodger was young David Jones, who later became the Davy Jones of the Monkees.
Wow.
So it's kind of interesting that on that show you had the Beatles and their eventual TV imitators.
We're speaking with Alan Kozin, music critic for the New York Times. His most recent ebook is Got That Something, How the Beatles' I Want to Hold Your Hand Changed Everything. He also wrote the biography The Beatles, From the Cavern to the Rooftop, marking the 50th anniversary of their arrival in the U.S. today, 50 years ago. You mentioned Brian Epstein, who was the Beatles' manager, got them this deal, this unusual deal with Ed Sullivan. He was a classical music guy by inclination.
Right.
He sort of fell in with the Beatles. You also have done a lot of classical music writing for the New York Times over the years. What is it about the Beatles? I mean, Leonard Bernstein also sort of cottoned on to the Beatles pretty quickly. Glenn Gould, what is it about classical music fans and the Beatles?
I think that classical music fans who listen to the music can see that there's something going on there. You know, there's interesting harmonic progressions. You know, the Beatles tended, except in very few cases, to avoid the basic 1-4-5 progression that was the sort of blues progression that's the heart of a lot of rock.
Right.
They tended to like unusual chords, unusual harmonies, and they were great melodists. Leonard Bernstein called them the Schuberts of our time.
If I trust in you, oh please, don't run and hide. If I love you too, oh please, don't hurt my pride like her, 'cause I couldn't stand the pain.
I found an article from 1964, early 64, it was in the New York Times, in which a reporter interviewed Leopold Stokowski about the Beatles.
The great conductor, yeah.
Yeah, who was at that point, you know, relatively up there age-wise.
Mm-hmm.
And he was actually very in favor as well, although his reasons were a little different. He wasn't coming out necessarily for or against the music as such. What he recognized was whatever it is that young kids see in this, it's making them love music.
Yeah.
And anything that makes people love music is, in his book, a good thing.
Yep.
So.
All right. So the guy who famously shook hands with Mickey Mouse in Fantasia. Big
That's
fan
right.
of the Beatles as well. We're talking with Alan Kozin about the 50th anniversary of the Beatles. By this point, February 7th, 1964, how much Beatles stuff is there for their screaming fans? Is it just the one record and a couple of singles? Is that it?
You mean in 1964?
Yeah.
Well, there was Meet the Beatles. There were a handful of singles because the early singles that came out on VJ and Swan were and did nothing in the United States in 1963 were immediately reissued because the companies that had the rights to them saw the possibilities. There were tons of instant publication magazines, you know, pictures of the Beatles and semi-fictitious stories about their lives and some real information here and there. But
what were those singles, the VJ and the Swan songs, the ones that initially did nothing? What were they?
Right, Please Please Me and Ask Me Why, From Me to You and Thank You Girl, and then on Swan there was She Loves You and I'll Get You.
Mm-hmm. Hard to believe that this song might have been issued and nearly sank without a trace, but let's hear She Loves You from the Beatles.
She loves you, yeah, yeah, yeah. She loves you, yeah, yeah, yeah. She loves you, yeah, 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 yeah. You think you've lost your love? Well, I saw her yesterday, yeah. It's you she's thinking of, and she don't. Tonight.
we're marking the 50th anniversary of the Beatles' arrival in the United States. They landed at JFK on this day 50 years ago. Are we now in for the next 7 years? For like every day is the 50th anniversary of the Beatles doing something for the first time, you know?
Well, sure, John. In fact, actually, you know, if you're fascinated with this stuff, that started in October 2012 when it was the 50th anniversary of the release of "Love Me Do."
Right.
But you know, keep in mind we got the 50th anniversary of Sgt. Pepper coming up in 2017, mm-hmm. and the White Album in 2018, then the tragic breakup in 2020.
All this week, Alan, we've been talking, in the run-up to the Sochi Olympics about music in Russia,
mm-hmm.
including talking about that samizdat, you know, the right. underground stuff.
Mm-hmm.
In the 60s, any idea how much of the youth culture movement that was so evident here in the West was actually going on there?
There apparently was a bunch, and there's a book you might have seen called How the Beatles Rocked the Kremlin by Leslie Woodard, he spent some time in the Soviet Union, and he talked to people and got to hear what they were interested in and how. And, officially the Soviet Union really seriously disliked the Beatles. They were obviously, Western degraded decadence. And it's interesting because the very right wing in the United States also liked the Beatles because they were, you know, they were going to make your kids be into communism. In fact, there was an author named David Nobel who used to write these tracts about, you know, what was evil about the Beatles, and one of them was called Communism, Hypnotism, and the Beatles. So it's a weird mirror image.
At least it's a clever title.
So
unofficially, I mean, officially, Beatles were sort of persona non grata in the Soviet Union. So is there any evidence that that this youth culture thing, that this surreptitious drip of Beatles music into the Soviet Union sort of opened floodgates for something later?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure if there's actual evidence, but people who live there say so. And even, you know, behind the Iron Curtain, I mean, Václav Havel used to say, you know,
the former president of the Czech Republic,
he spoke about it, and even I think he wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times about how the Beatles were so important to him. At that time and, through.
You could definitely, if someone had said the Beatles sounded like freedom or a breath of fresh air to us behind the curtain, you could imagine how it could feel that way to someone.
Sure.
Just from the sound, the way their records were made, you know?
Right. You know, I mean, they're living in a fairly grim society, even just materially. You know, we're talking about people standing online to get bread, boots, whatever. And what they're hearing is these cassettes or tapes of this music that supposedly everybody is listening to in the West, and it sounds like we're having a really great time. And, you know, we were. So that has to have been attractive to them. And, it's funny because over the years I've run into in collector shops these strange Melodia pressings of EPs and LPs of Beatles stuff, which you know was not authorized.
Yeah, because Melodia was the state-run record label.
So, you know, I wonder if it was really Melodia or bootleg with a Melodia label, because neither EMI had authorized Russian releases because, they supposedly were banned from there, and the Russian state label wouldn't have put out the stuff either. So who knows what these records were, but the sound was pretty, awful.
Samizdat culture strikes again.
There you go.
Alan Kozin is a music critic for the New York Times. His recent ebook is called Got That Something? How the Beatles' I Wanna Hold Your Hand Changed Everything. You could say everything changed on this date 50 years ago when the Beatles landed here in the U.S. for the first time. Alan, thanks once again for joining us.
Thank you, John.
This is Soundcheck.
Oh, yeah, I tell you something. I think you'll understand. When I say that something, I wanna hold your hand. I wanna hold your hand.
coming up, a visit from singer, songwriter, and author Steve Earle. He'll play a song for Valentine's Day, and he'll help us kick off our search for the most romantic song ever. Steve Earle, next on Soundcheck.
Have a case of cold pills soaking in a milk jug. Hydrochloric acid, iodine, and phosphorus. Careful not to get any on you when you shake it up. That's the way we
go. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The last time Steve Earle joined us on Soundcheck, it was to talk about his Hank Williams-inspired debut novel called I'll Never Get Out of This World Alive, and to play us a couple of songs from his album of the same name. Well, as it turns out, Steve Earle's writing career was just getting started. 3 years later, the singer-songwriter has also released a book of short stories. He's working on a second novel and a memoir. We'll talk with him about all those projects in a moment. But first, here he is to play us a song, Steve's Hammer for Pete. It's Steve Earle, live on Soundcheck.
One of these days I'm gonna lay this hammer down. Leave my burden resting on the ground. When ain't no hunger and ain't no pain, I won't have to swing and sing. One of these days I'm gonna lay this hammer down. One of these nights I'm gonna sing a different tune. All night long beneath the silvery moon. When the war's over and the Union's strong, won't sing no more angry songs. One of these nights I'm gonna sing a different tune. Someday when my struggle's through, I won't have to strive. All I can do is let this hammer fly. One of these nights I'm gonna play this hammer down. Leave my burden resting on the ground. When all those sailing the ocean's clean, kids don't die for gasoline. One of these days I'm gonna lay this hammer down. John Henry was a mighty man. He worked his whole life long.
That is Steve Earle, live on Soundcheck, and the song Steve's Hammer for Pete. The subtitle, Steve, referring to the late, great Pete Seeger.
Yeah, and I wrote it, you know, so that was on Washington Square Serenade, which was, I guess...
6 years ago, 7 years ago?
It's been more like eight. So a year I moved to New York, but he was like 90, he was going to be 95 in May, you know, he was closer to 95 than 94, so... that's a good run for anybody, but also on the other side of it, we had Pete a long time, and he was. I hope that I'm doing what I'm doing as high a percentage of my life as Pete was. He was working pretty much to the end.
Yeah.
Now men and women, young and old, reject the lies we've all been told. No more bing, bang, boomerang, peace instead of war. That's what life is really for.
No more bing, bang, boomerang, peace instead of war. That's what life is really for.
Steve Earle with us on Soundcheck, remembering the late, great Pete Seeger. Steve Earle is playing a series of all-request shows at City Winery right across the street from our New York studio every Wednesday night this month. What are the perils, the pitfalls, and the rewards of doing an all-request show?
I have no idea. I've never done one before. The first one will be tonight. You know, it's one of those things. I think there's a tendency to hate requests because there's that person that comes and yells for the one song that they know you for.
Right.
I actually I have two or three of them, and you know, there's people that think that Copperhead Road was my first record, and it's not. You know, and there's people that request songs off Guitar Town. In Ireland, I'll be remembered for the Galway Girl. There's not any doubt about that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so. It's not, you know, but I don't know. The older I get, I've asked for requests several times. I started on solo shows last year. With a band, I don't do it very much.
Right,
But on solo shows, I started taking requests. It's chaos, though. People start yelling out, start trying to out.
So how do you do it?
There'll be a card for every single person that's in the City Winery. I think the cap's 300. There will be 300 cards distributed around the table. So everybody gets a whack at the pinata.
Okay.
And you get to write down your request, and it's going to go into a hat, and I'm going to draw the set as I go along and play it. If I run into two or three dirges in a row and I have written some, then I may push the card back and play it after I come up with a couple of up-tempo things to sort of keep the set going.
But I will
play everything I draw.
Are there Steve Earle songs that you don't remember how to play?
I had a book made for this occasion with all of the lyrics. I have virtually everything I've ever written in one book now, and it's going to sit there in case I get stumped.
And when some Weisenheimer requests Free Bird, what do you do?
They get a free bird. But well, we can't really go into that on the radio. So. I don't like Lynyrd Skynyrd. I kind of never did. So it's one of those things. It's not a song that I would take kindly to having requested one of my shows anyway.
Right. But it is one of those, that and Whipping Post, you know.
I love Whipping Post, but, you know, that's the Allman Brothers. That's a whole other level of art.
Right.
But it's just one of those deals.
In addition to the songs, you've been writing novels and short stories. What about this memoir? What's the status of that right now?
The memoir is what I'm working on at present. It's, you know, it's hard because there's actually a lot of research involved because it's not an autobiography. It's a literary memoir that's largely about recovery. It's about mentors, and it's three acts, basically. The first part's about Townes Van Zandt and Guy Clark and, you know, mainly Townes, but, you know, people that...
That meant something to
that
you.
That meant something to in what I do in my day job. And the second part is largely about two men who were first cousins and were both drug dealers and sort of protected me, not because they loved me, but because I was a commodity during the lowest period of my life. And right before I went to jail and after I was in jail. And then the third part is about my grandfather, who started nearly every 12-step meeting in Northeast Texas. He's actually my mother's stepfather. And he got sober here in New York City right after World War II. So that means that he knew Bill W. and he knew Dr. Bob. And so I've gone into – I grew up with the Serenity Prayer and the Steps on the Wall. So I had that resource to draw on. He was long gone. He died in 1966. But I suddenly realized who those guys that were sleeping on his couch were. And that's it gave me an immediate connection to what has saved my life and what still saves my life on a day-in, day-out basis, which is I still go to meetings and call my sponsor. That's what I do. That's the center of my life.
Yeah. So the memoir, how far along are you?
Well, it's like I'm Haven't finished the first part yet. I'm maybe halfway through the first part of it. And I backtracked to write like a prologue that's about my father, a short piece that's about my father, because my father isn't one of these mentors, and there's a reason for it. And I just felt like that was worth touching on. Mm. And so I backtracked to that, and I'm working on that right now. But, you know, I should publish it, early next year, hopefully.
Well, yeah. All right. Steve Earle with us on Soundcheck today. Many, many projects being juggled at the moment. Steve is playing a series of all-request shows at City Winery here in New York every Wednesday night in the month of February. So can I make a request?
Sure.
All right, well, Valentine's Day is coming up.
It is, absolutely. And I'll that'll probably come up in one of the... I predict that's one song that will get requested. I'll get a lot of Copperhead Road and...
But it's such a sweet song, you know. I don't have a card to sign. Roses have been hard to find.
Desperation.
I hope you'll be mine on Valentine's Day.
Well, it was desperation. It was like I literally had just gotten out of jail, just gotten clean, and I couldn't get any kind of license, and I could not drive, and I did not push my luck and drive. I had a driver eventually, but I didn't even have the driver yet at this point because I got out of jail, and you know, it's like this is in December, and it's like this is February 14th of 1995, and I realized late in the day on February 13th that I wasn't going to be able to get anywhere and do anything about Valentine's Day. So it was... come to you with empty hands, guess I just forgot again. Only got my love to send for Valentine's Day. I ain't got a card to send. Roses have been hard to find. I only hope that you be mine for Valentine's Day. I know that I swore that I wouldn't forget. Wrote it all down. I lost it, I guess. There's so much I wanna see, and all the words just slip away. The way you love me every day is Valentine's Day. If I could, you know I would deliver to you diamonds and gold. It's the least I can do. So if you take my hope, where I'll make it up to you. Then I hope my heart will do for Valentine's Day. For Valentine's Day.
Steve Earle with the song Valentine's Day, live on Soundcheck. So Valentine's Day is coming up, and all next week we're going to be asking our Soundcheck listeners for what they think is the most romantic song of all time.
Wow. There's probably a lot of songs I could come up with if I really thought about what pops into my head, just because it has to do with when I started playing and what I took to be romantic and employed that way is probably Sunlight by the Youngbloods. you know, Jesse Colin Young song.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's the way she feels about you. It was guaranteed, you know, girls would pay. It was two songs you had to know playing the places I was playing in Texas. You had to learn, Help Me Make It to the Night. There were a lot of cowboy hats, and you had to know Sunlight, that there was a lot of, you know, bell bottoms.
Running in a field of brown, laughing, rolling on the ground, smiling as she pulls you down. That's the way she feels about you. That's the way she feels about you.
That's the Youngbloods with Sunlight. That's Steve Earle's pick for the most romantic song ever. For now, at least. Steve's been my guest here in the Soundcheck studio. He's doing his all-request shows every Wednesday this month at City Winery here in New York. Steve, always great to have you with us here on Soundcheck. Thanks very much.
Good to be here. Thank you.
She will bend to take you in. Makes no difference where you've been. That's the way she feels about you. That's the way she feels about you. Screaming, scared by what you're dreaming. You know she is there, she can share. You're aware she cares about you. In the morning, wake up laughing with the day.
You can make your case for the most romantic song ever. Head over to soundcheck.org to do so, or leave us a voicemail at 866-939-1612. We'll be playing some of your picks on the show next week and compiling some of the best answers for our Valentine's Day show. Again, that number, 866-939-1612, or soundcheck.org. Coming up on Monday, B.J. Novak. You might know him from his role as Ryan, the well-dressed temp on the NBC series The Office. He'll give us his pick for the most romantic song, and he'll talk about his new book of short stories called One More Thing. Also, live music from the Minneapolis singer-songwriter Jeremy Messersmith. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.